Welcome to Rewind, a podcast of 90s nostalgia. I'm one of your hosts, Mike Chin, and I'm here with my co-host, Mike Scalise. Mike, how are you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing well, thanks. We're here today. I'm especially doing well because we're here to talk about something near and dear to my heart, which is 1990s professional wrestling. So I think pretty much anyone who knows me knows that I'm a wrestling fan. I have been pretty much my entire life, and I'll get into that a little bit more about kind of my origins with that. But I will say that from childhood I watched it, and I've continued right up to present day. I don't watch it necessarily on a weekly basis anymore, but I still keep up with the storylines and who's who and all that. So for me, this is a fun one to kind of zero in on. But I guess just as a frame of reference, I could talk wrestling all day and all different eras and so on and so forth. But what about yourself? Where would you kind of localize or centralize your own wrestling fanhood?
Well, I would say that it started with probably in the early 90s when we actually, I think we met on the same school bus to our elementary school. You had brought a WWF magazine with you. Yeah. And I think shortly, right around that time, maybe shortly before that, I had, I'd obviously caught a few events on TV, and I think that was kind of what really sparked my interest, is seeing, all these wrestlers and high flying moves and, just athleticism. So it was some nice common ground for us to be able to talk about the magazine and the sport in general.
Yeah, and it's funny because, I think we knew who each other were. We lived down the street from each other. Like we're talking like a 2-minute walk, between our houses. We rode the same school bus, but we weren't friends. I don't think we were unfriendly, but, we didn't hang out or anything or really talk very much. But I remember Hulk Hogan was on the cover of that magazine. I think it was one that came out a little bit after WrestleMania 9. And I think you struck up a conversation because you saw me, talk about it with somebody else. And that one thing leads to another. And that was kind of, the start of our friendship, where, I think of basketball, which we talked about in our first episode, as being, a little more at the bedrock of our friendship, as something that we were both into for a longer period of time. I think that's a part of why wrestling is special to me, is that, with you and then with a number of other folks in my life too, that was kind of the foundation, or at least the starting point of, our friendship. So, I have this theory, and you're actually kind of the exception to this theory, which we'll talk about in a moment here, but I have this theory that, kids from like roughly our generation were kind of uniquely equipped to be wrestling fans for an extended period of time, because there's the whole Hulkamania era, from the mid-80s into the early 90s, where Hogan is everywhere, where the WWF becomes a national brand. And I think, people who weren't paying, super close attention might not even realize that wrestling wasn't kind of always a thing, but it used to be, very territorial, where, in the Northeast, WWF was kind of the thing, but then in the Southeast, the NWA more or less ran things, and, in the Midwest, AWA ran things, and there were all these other little promotions that had kind of, their dedicated sections of the country, and then there were some international companies. But WWF really kind of took off with Hulk Hogan as kind of the star, with Vince McMahon as the mastermind, becomes this national brand. And we're kids, right when the product kind of takes this turn to be a little bit less realistic, to have all these big flamboyant characters, not just Hogan, but Macho Man Randy Savage and the Ultimate Warrior and all these guys that are sort of built for kids in a lot of ways, right? And also just kind of icons of the business. But, a time when wrestling kind of explodes. And then it's bookended, it comes circles back around after a little lull period in between, where, Hogan tries to retire and when he goes to WCW, and it sort of just feels sort of played out, like it's kind of like an act that's time has passed, to him turning into a bad guy for the first time in, a decade or more. Starting the NWO in WCW, and that leads to the rise of Sting as the Crow and Goldberg and Diamond Dallas Page. And meanwhile in WWF, it's Stone Cold Steve Austin taking off, and The Rock and Triple H and DX. And all of a sudden, this generation of kids who were super into Hulkamania when we were 5, 6, 7 years old, then we get to see kind of the next iteration where, oh, wrestling is cool now. right? Where people are like drinking beer on TV and giving each other the finger and telling them to suck it and all this stuff that, you know, hasn't all aged very well at this point. We'll get into that, you know, later on in the show, but nonetheless, it's kind of catered to a teenager, right? Who's feeling kind of rebellious at that time. So we kind of, you know, get the best of the kid stuff when we're kids, we get the best of the teenage stuff when we're teenagers. And I think for me, that in large part set me up for life, right? That I carried on, you know, because those parts of it were just so appealing to me. And then, you know, just got hooked permanently. But for you, I feel like your fanhood was largely kind of centered in sort of what I would consider to be that lull period in between, right? Where you know, Hulkamania isn't everything that it once was, where, you know, he's kind of getting a little bit older and the act is kind of getting a little bit tired. And before WCW really hits its stride and does anything that's super popular. But more of that era when like, you know, Bret Hart and Lex Luger and Diesel are kind of the top guys in WWF. But have I got that right? Does that seem kind of like more your time?
I would completely agree with that. I mean, you know, you talked about the territories of the different federations and whatnot. And I knew nothing of that. And WCW, you know, while it eventually grew in popularity, was not on my radar. I mean, you're absolutely right. It was right around the when Bret Hart was becoming extremely popular and where WWF was it. And so, yeah, I probably did kind of start really engaging in that lull period, as you said.
Yeah, and I think it's fun though, because, you know, just despite kind of, you know, getting hooked in that time, that being, you know, I think when you were most into it, and probably by extension, part of what helped me stay most into it during that time, because we would just talk wrestling all the time back in the day. But, you know, I think it was an era when we had, you know, archives kind of what happened before it. So there were all these, you know, videotapes and there were, you know, magazines and books that kind of, you know, documented what had happened before. So you could kind of relive the exciting stuff from before. And then, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, if your perception is different, but I feel as though even if you weren't really watching wrestling, if you were a teenager in that time period, people around you were watching wrestling and kind of talking about it. Like you couldn't totally avoid, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin, DX, that kind of stuff. Like it just kind of permeated the culture at a certain.
Yes. Point. Yes, it did. It did. Because yeah, people were quoting what wrestlers were saying. People were, you know, mimicking what wrestlers were doing. It's in some aspects of your life. I mean, like you said, it permeated. And so you would see that, And I'll even say, you know, back then, you know, I hear about my parents talking about how there was, when they were children, you know, there were three channels on TV and they only operated, you know, from, you know, 9 a.m. until a certain period of time in the afternoon or night. And so, obviously not to that extent, but there were fewer channels, there were fewer options on TV. Mm-hmm. So in some respects, if you were watching TV, anybody really, the likelihood that you would come across a wrestling event is not terrible. It's fairly you know, probable. And so I do think that we all probably, especially the teenagers who were watching TV, had some sort of affiliation, whether we liked it or not.
Yeah, no, and it's one of those things where it's kind of the good and the bad of it, but I do sort of feel as though you sort of, you know, couldn't avoid it. And now, you know, relative to where we are today, like, you know, again, you know, I'm still a wrestling fan, so I've got the WWE Network that I pay my $9.99 a month to, you know, subscribe to. And it's sort of, you know, the good and the bad, where I feel like if I had that when I was a kid, I would have just watched that all the time. And I probably would have, you know, killed my brain watching so much wrestling. But at the same time, now as an adult, I feel like I don't have the time. I can't justify, you know, watching more than, you know, I watch the, you know, monthly-ish pay-per-views. And then, you know, I'd say once or twice a month, I'll dabble in some old stuff and some of the documentaries they put out. But yeah, like you said, I mean, back in that time, you just kind of stumble upon it on TV. And that's basically your entry point to it. But there were live events too, right? And living in, you know, Utica, New York, where we were as kids, you know, not you know, a big metropolis or anything, but the WWF did come through town, you know, at least, you know, I would say on average, I don't know, maybe you know, one to three times a year, I would very roughly say, you know, and we went to some of those shows. And I was just curious about, you know, your memories of going to you know, WWF events live.
Yeah, you know, to tell you the truth, I remember going to two different events, and I couldn't even tell you the year. I could tell you that, you know, the time frame was what you were referring to before is probably the early to mid 90s. And the two things I remember, one was, for whatever reason, I remember seeing Virgil come flying out to the ring for one of the events. I don't know who he was facing, but for that one, I remember being, the seats weren't anything special, you know, it was just like, you know, it was just, you know, amidst the crowd, the normal, you know, I don't know how much the tickets were back then, but they, you know, they weren't ultra expensive. And, but then I do remember being for the other event in the second row, such that I remember when Bret Hart, again, I don't remember who he was facing, but I remember Bret Hart was wrestling in that event. And I got a chance to kind of go up to the, you know, the, steel perimeter the railing. Yeah. And I got to like, not shake his hand, but, you know, give him a high five kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, as a young man, child really, and being so into it, like that was really kind of cool. And of course at that point I had to get all the merchandise. I had to get the cool sunglasses that were pink and then, you know, and all that good stuff. But yeah, so those are my two memories of actually attending events in Utica that were, you know, for WWF. How about yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, and I was going to say, I mean, I should take a little step back. I think I meant to get into this a little bit earlier, but kind of, you know, my origins as a fan in terms of my grandfather was a huge wrestling fan. And so he was a Chinese immigrant. You know, he never really learned how to speak English very well. And I think he was drawn to wrestling. And I think that, you know, it was a couple things. One is that thing you already hit on where, you know, in previous generations, there was barely anything on TV, right? So it might happen to surface on TV, you know, and he didn't even, I'm sure, have TV when he first came over. But when he had TV, he had access to that. But secondarily, just in terms of, you know, entertainment he could understand. It's two guys fighting. Everyone's cheering for this one guy. Everyone's booing this other guy. Easy to follow, right? I know who the good guys are. I know who the bad guys are. I can follow the fight. I can understand this kind of entertainment. There's no super complicated rules to get into, no advanced plot. Like, it just, you know, is what it is. You know, and he passed on to my dad, who, you know, was born in the U.S., you know, and was very much indoctrinated in American culture. But my dad used to go to Madison Square Garden and see shows live. And it's actually on my bucket list to one day do that myself. I still, even though it feels like something I probably should have done by this point, I never did it. So to him, going to a live event was kind of, you know, the be all end all of being a wrestling fan. So whereas, you know, we were kind of growing up in an era when, you know, pay-per-view events were a big deal, and that's where they would save all the big matches for. My dad was still very much of a mindset where, you know, live events were kind of the thing. And so, you know, we went to a number of them. I remember he always used to call into those radio call-in shows where if you're the ninth caller or whatever, or, you know, the answer to the trivia question, you know, you win a prize. So whenever the WWF was coming into town, he would call into those contests and try to get us tickets because of what a big fan I was, and because he was still, you know, watching it. And he claimed it was just to monitor what I was watching and kind of supervise. And I think some of that was true, because I think he actually has, you know, finally stopped watching wrestling in his older age. But nonetheless, I think he enjoyed it too, you know, for a number of years. You know, we would go together. My sister was into it when she was, you know, much, much younger. I think she got out of it by the time she was like, you know, 10 years old or so. But, you know, I stuck with it, and my dad and I would watch it together. Yeah, and I remember, you know, us going to a number of shows. I remember he brought you and I to a show at one point, I remember. It was, first we went to Pizza Hut to try to meet Razor Ramon, because he was doing an autograph signing.
Oh, that's right. Yep, I remember that.
Like, I think it was like, you know, 2 or 3 hours in line, and it hardly made any, you know, never got through the door of the Pizza Hut before Razor Ramon kind of just called it and left. Little did I know, I don't know if I've told you this before, but I've read a lot about this, including in Bret Hart's book and in some other ones, where apparently that's just something that he did in that era, was that he kind of just, you know, he had to do these autograph signings. He kind of put the minimum effort in of like, I'll show up for an hour or two, and then there's still a line out the door, and he was like, I don't need to do this. And he would just scram and not worry about it. So little did we know as kids, you know, clutching our 8x10s for him to autograph, that he was just going to leave us high and dry. But you know, that's how that played out for us.
Wonderful, good people, these, right? These wrestlers right. Turned out to be.
No, I understand he's turned it around. I understand now he's very kind and will be very patient and wait around for like 4 or 5 hours to sign autographs. But anyway, well, I don't know if you remember that show, but I remember that I'm pretty sure it was a Monday Night Raw taping that my dad brought us to. Not a super, I don't remember hardly any of the actual wrestling from that show. I just remember us hanging out there. So for whatever that's worth, but.
I do remember going to Pizza Hut and waiting in that line, and it actually cost us more than our time, because I'm pretty sure while we were in line, like Pizza Hut would sell like breadsticks or something, or pizza, slices of pizza. Mind you, this Pizza Hut is long gone. But that does make sense though, because that's why he was doing it, because there was a show that night, and I didn't realize it was a Raw Monday Night Raw taping.
Yeah, and I could have that confused. I know I went to a few Raw tapings in that era, and I think that one was one, though. You know,
again, okay.
You know, whatever. It's 25 years ago now, so.
Yeah, right. But I do remember that. It's funny when we talk about, like you had mentioned earlier, you know, our first episode was about basketball, and that lasted, I think, longer for the two of us, you know, collectively. But when we, you know, when we speak strictly about wrestling, I'm really having to look back. Yeah. Literally 25 years.
Yeah.
To remember some of the things that we've done, but, well, for not for all of it, but yeah, for a lot of it, when we were really, really deep into it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and we don't have to go way into it, but you know, I remember those wrestling magazines, cause you know, and I think some of this is just, it's a sign of the pre-internet era, right? Because now, I've spent, you know, hours, especially when I was working office jobs and I had like, you know, a patch where it wasn't very busy, just I'll read one like interview with a wrestler or one, you know, news story about a wrestler, and then that leads to a link to another one, to another one, to another one, and all of a sudden, you know, 3 or 4 hours have vanished. Just reading about this stuff. But back before the internet, you know, it was scraping to get information about wrestling. And a lot of the magazines still maintain what would they call kayfabe, which is basically the idea that wrestling is real, that they pretend that it's not a storyline, that it's all, you know, on the up and up. And still, I remember that we were fascinated with that stuff, right? Like UF magazine itself, there was, you know, Pro Wrestling Illustrated and The Wrestler and Inside Wrestling. And however many other ones there were. Did you remember anything about those magazines and collecting them and all that?
Well, you know, it's funny. They were so 90s. Like when I remember like the I don't know if you call it the marketing or just the aesthetics of it, but like I can picture one right now, and the WWF magazine, and how they'd have you know, like again, somebody that we all admired or definitely knew about on the cover, and I do remember collecting them and talking about them. And you're absolutely right. This was the way to get information pre-internet. You know, when we were allowed 5 hours a month on AOL, you know what I mean? Dial up and all that. But and what also, not to kind of detract from the magazine piece, but I remember also the, do you remember, was it Bobby Heenan with like the one, he had like 1-900 numbers you could call to get some inside tracks of, happening?
My understanding is Gene Okerlund was kind of the mastermind of managing that business. Like he did it a lot for WWF, and then he actually brought that over to WCW. I've learned in interviews subsequently that was part of his kind of what he brought to the table, part of why he garnered the salary that he did, was he was like, I've done this 900 number stuff for, you know, the last decade. I can totally bring this over. And net you an extra, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of dollars for kids calling in and being kept on hold for, you know, 2 or 3 minutes, and then you give them a little, you know, nugget of information. And then all of a sudden their parents have an extra $20 on their phone bill for that month. They've given them. But yeah, I mean, Heenan was involved. I think a bunch of those personalities were involved in that.
Well, so yeah, but all that to say though, I mean, like it's, and by the way, I think I called one of those one time, and sure enough, there was the charge the next month. I heard about it from my parents, but yeah, I mean, like, you know, you kind of have like the magazine. It makes sense. You know, you have like the magazines and what was accurate and current as of the printing of that, the publishing of that. And then, you know, the 900 numbers and you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, the internet takes the lead with all of that and kind of renders a lot of those things obsolete. And now, as you said, at your fingertips, you have all the information you could ask for. You know, with the streaming service that you're part of, you have all the events that you could pretty much ask for. So,
it's getting a little bit ahead here, but it's funny how technology has sort of changed so many aspects of how we access wrestling. Because magazines, I mean, they still exist, but they're largely obsolete now, right? Just because you can get the same stuff and often better stuff, more current stuff on the internet. Pay-per-view kind of got replaced by streaming services, where some of the smaller companies still do individual pay-per-views where you've got to pay, you know, $40-$50 for this show. And even though there's some of that I actually get excited for, and it's like, man, I really would kind of like to do that, I just can't do it because I know I just pay $10 a month to WWE and get, you know, all of their stuff. So it's kind of ruined that business for me. And I can't imagine calling a 900 number at this point, right? Because that same information, like if they still had that, people still did that, I'm sure the first person to call it would just then post on the internet whatever they'd heard.
Exactly.
And none of the rest of us would have to call after that.
Exactly. It just changes things altogether.
But I mean, with the magazines, you know, and y'all, the artwork was such a big piece of it too. Just the look of it, like you said, you can picture it in your head. It was so exciting to get your hands on something like that in that era. And I think a similar logic applies to, you know, renting videos, right? Like, you walk into the Blockbuster and you see that whole shelf full of, WWF videos. You're waiting for the latest, you know, pay-per-view show to come out. Any memories for you of that whole experience of accessing, you know, the videos to rent or to buy even?
Yeah. I mean, that was such a huge piece of it. You know, the Blockbuster that was in our town or in our city, next to the grocery store, you know, when it was literally, I think the first shelf that you saw when you walked in, if I remember correctly, and it was just lined with VHS tapes of wrestling. And again, I talked about it on all the other shows, you know, completist in me, at least for this at the time. And I had intentions of renting all of those. I mean, there were just shelves. And again, if I got into it around WrestleMania 9, that meant that I had 8 WrestleManias to catch up on, not to mention, you know, whatever else was coming out at the time. I mean, I don't remember the exact schedules of things, but there were SummerSlams, there were WWF Raws, there were, or Monday Night Raws, there were, you know, King of the Ring, there was just so much out there. And so, but I remember my grandmother, you know, God bless her soul, would take me, you know, she'd go to the grocery store and I'd get to go to Blockbuster next door and I'd get to, you know, just look up and down and see, you know, what I hadn't rented yet. And that's what I would do. I'd rent it, go home, play it, you know, rewind it, and then, bring it back in a few days. So
it's such a lost part of our culture, you know, and I think a lot of times people, you know, talk about and kind of romanticize the movie aspect of it, which for sure was a huge thing of just, you know, being able to, you know, go into a video store and, look at all the different movie options and, you know, and talk to other people who are, you know, into movies. If that was kind of your speed. The wrestling piece of that, I mean, you know, maybe it's because both of us were, you know, just wrestling nerds at that point, but that was such an appealing thing, right? Just to see all of them out there. And, we'll talk about pay-per-views in just a second here, but, you know, I remember, some of my very earliest memories were of watching WrestleMania 3 and 4. And we didn't watch them live because we never paid for a pay-per-view in our house, but I remember watching them on VHS tape and just, like, you know, just being so completely enthralled with it at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and in retrospect, especially WrestleMania 4, most kind of, you know, hardcore fans consider that one of the worst WrestleManias ever, but I'm always gonna have a soft spot for it just because of, you know, my memories of being so excited. It was a tournament for the vacant world title, and you're getting caught up in all of that. But I did want to transition there though, to talking just for a second about pay-per-views, because I remember, I'll say before we really started hanging out, very shortly before it, was the first time I ever watched a pay-per-view live, which was, WrestleMania 9 itself, which was, again, my dad doing one of those radio call-in shows and, you know, winning the contest. And then, We got to, you know, watch it free at our house. And I had, you know, one of my friends and his brother over to watch it. And that was like the perfect time because my fanhood was reaching like a fever pitch at that point. I was at the end of elementary school and was just, you know, super, super into it. But then I remember watching a number of pay-per-views down the road with you. What are your memories? You know, and again, I'm sure, like you said, it's hard to keep track of all of them because even then there were a number of them. You know, now the number has exploded. It used to be, you know, four or five of them a year. Now it's one pretty much every month, sometimes more than one a month. Good luck catching up on all that.
Yeah, right.
Try it now. But yeah, what are your memories of those kinds of shows?
Well, you know, it's funny because they do kind of get conflated with some of the other, like we were talking about, like I've rented a bunch of tapes and I'm trying to decipher what actually I saw on pay-per-view and what was something I rented. But one that for sure stands out, and it might've been the first one that my parents were nice enough to pay for. And I think that was WrestleMania 10. We had become friends at that point. If I remember correctly, I think you came over and I want to say another two friends of mine that were kind of in the neighborhood.
I think that's right.
Had come over. And again, you know, as you said, these were $40, $50 events, you know? And so my parents were really nice enough to foot that bill. And I think they got us pizza. And you know, this could have been what sparked what we talked about in a different episode of our New Year's Eve extravaganza, where we just watch TV for hours and hours with more snacks than any two adolescents or children could or should ever eat. But in any case, so I do remember WrestleMania 10 and just being incredibly into the whole wrestling scene and getting to see Bret Hart, Razor Ramon. You know, Owen Hart, just Yokozuna was big right around then, mm-hmm. too. I mean, he was big probably his whole life, but it's funny because I remember that we had this addition put onto our house not long after that, which is where all of the entertainment turned to, it became our new living room and the TV was moved and all that, but that was an event I remember being in our old living room in our much smaller kind of house before that addition. So that's my earliest memory of a pay-per-view in my house. But I'm fairly certain we had quite a few more after that.
Summer slams
or whatnot. Yeah.
Right. But I think you kind of nailed it though, that like, it was such an event in that time period, you know, and some of it's just getting older and some of it's, again, the sheer volume of them now. I remember just getting so excited as a kid because it was like, okay, this is like the thing we've been building towards for months, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, when you only have, you know, 10 years of life experience to, you know, match that against, that's a huge deal when this has been building for months and these are the ones you're looking forward to and all that. So in WrestleMania 10, I think, you know, more objectively, I think even now most you know, hardcore fans would say that was a really good WrestleMania, and so it makes complete sense that we would be all the more hooked, you know, after watching that one live. The funny thing is, I remember, you know, now they all happen at night. I remember that was an afternoon show. Mm-hmm. I remember that for two reasons. One, I remember I was hanging at my grandma's house. We used to do that every Sunday. It was a big deal because I was leaving early from that to go to your house to watch WrestleMania. And I was really excited for that. I kept asking what time it was.
Grandma, I'm sorry I have to leave, but Bret Hart and Yokozuna are.
I mean, she knew. She there was no question that I would be, you know, excited. Yeah. but also, this is completely random. But I remember going home afterwards and our family watching The Fugitive together because we'd rented that from out of his Blockbuster or Farmhouse or whichever one. But like that was just, you know, kind of like, it was pretty recently on VHS at that point. It was kind of a big deal that we'd managed to get that VHS at that time. And so, you know, that just being like one of the best days of my being, you know, whatever it was, 10 years old of,
did you also play with a snap bracelet?
The Fugitive.
Did you also play with a snap bracelet or do anything else that's incredibly
nice? Probably, right? But another thing I remember of us being, fans and, you know, friends together, was trying out the moves on each other, right? Yeah. And specifically, I remember suffering my share of sharpshooters. And you know, even then, I think they said, don't try this at home. They've gotten a lot more adamant and visible about that, I think, based on some lawsuits. But yeah, anything about all that?
I remember, yeah, a ton of sharpshooters. I remember, you know, as I mentioned before, my grandmother used to take me to the Blockbuster, and she lived with us for quite a while. And in her downstairs apartment, I remember there was an open area where you and I could, if we wanted to, just do wrestling moves on each other, and we did. And so I distinctly remember putting you in a sharpshooter, and it's so funny because you see it on TV, and you know, you see what looks to be the other, you know, the person that's in the sharpshooter in pain and all that. But like, when you think about like the science of it, like, wait, what is it supposed to, like, you know, really be hurting their back? I mean, it looks like it might actually be feel kind of good if you stretch it the right, you know? So, but, and then there's always the reversal of it, you know, sometimes right. Like they would reverse it and you're like, oh wait, how does that completely reverse the pain now? Like, is that how that works? So it's just funny to look back on it like that.
Well, and it's something that, you know, Bret Hart and Ric Flair have both, you know, spoken very openly about, of that, like, with their signature moves. You know, Bret Hart was a sharpshooter, Ric Flair was the figure four leg lock. That they actually do hurt if you apply them, you know, the right way, you know, and if the person kind of, but like I said, the main thing being, like, someone has to let you put that hold on them. Like, there's no context in a real fight where you could actually, you know, grab someone's leg, spin around, bend it over, drop to the floor, put your other leg over theirs, and then just position it just right until it hurts, and then they're just going to stay there, right? Like, it's just absurd, you know. But I remember, but Ric Flair has told stories of like NFL players who are like, you just grew up as fans of wrestling, who are like, yeah, put me in the figure four. And he's like, really? Yeah. You do that? So he'll do it, and it will hurt, but he's like, you realize there's no possible way I could have gotten this on you if you didn't let me do it. Like it just wouldn't happen. So but yeah, I remember we had some fun with that, you know, and it's one of those things where in retrospect, yeah, it probably wasn't the safest thing. Like, some of those holes actually could hurt you or whatnot, but you know, as a side gig nowadays, I make memes for this company where it's like old school wrestling kind of references and things like that. And the most successful by far one that I ever put out was one of, it shows a sharpshooter in a figure four, and it says, if you ever tried putting this on one of your friends, can you even call yourself a child of the 90s? You know, and it got something like 30,000 some odd impressions, and you know, like over the hundreds of likes and all that and comments. And I think it's because so many of us who did grow up in that era did that kind of stuff, you know, like it's just sort of unavoidable again. Like, even if you weren't super interesting, you probably had a friend who did, who at least one time, you know, asked, hey, can I put you in a cross-faced chicken wing, or, you know, whatever it was.
Good old Bob Backlund, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's here's the thing. I think, if I'm not mistaken, you and I put each other in sharpshooters as recently as 2009, maybe.
Yeah, that's another story that I think we'll probably touch on later on.
Yeah.
But,
you know, I think we did it right. I mean, I'm not talking about the move, that's debatable, but I mean, in that, like, there were lots of moves that we could have chosen. Like, for what comes to mind is Tombstone Piledriver. I'm kind of glad we didn't even attempt that, even if we did it the right way so that we didn't, you know, break each other's necks. I feel like the risk was there. It would be there if we had tried that. So, you know, there's a small piece of me that's a little bit happy that we kind of kept it at the figure four and the sharpshooter and stuff. You know, some of the
You know, and I think that we were, you know, while doing that at all, it was probably a little bit reckless. You know, when we were knuckleheads, whatever. Like, we were still, I think, on the responsible side of kids with that sort of thing. Like, we weren't gonna, you know, jump off something super high to drop a flying elbow or something,
right.
To give a pile driver, or like, yeah, I mean, I think we sort of intuited, like, no, that's not a great idea. but in terms of, yeah, you know, yeah, just thinking about play and thinking about being kids in that era, the other thing I wanted to touch on was the Royal Rumble video game for Super Nintendo.
Oh yeah, I
had a ton of fun playing that. When I think back to you and I playing Super Nintendo together, I think of, you know, NBA Jam, which we talked about in the basketball episode, and Royal Rumble. That's the other one that my head goes straight to. I know there are a bunch of other ones we, you know, touched on here and there. What kind of memories did you have of playing Royal Rumble?
You know what? Here's the thing. I have actually quite a few memories of that, and I've played it even within the past year. I don't care if it's 16-bit graphics or whatever. One of the best games ever.
Yep.
But I'm gonna put it right back on you, because I'm gonna see if it lines up with what I was gonna say. What do you remember from this game?
Well, you know, the things that I remember are, it was a pretty limited roster. I think it was like 10 or 12 guys. So like not even enough to have like an actual Royal Rumble match. So that's traditionally a 30 man, match or 30 woman. Now they have the Women's Rumble as well. But I remember, we would play, you know, different modes, because you do Royal Rumble mode, you could do regular match, you tag teams, all that. The biggest thing I remember though is us going outside the ring and picking up the steel chair and smashing each other with it. And I think it's one of those things, and I think it's part of what attracts kids to wrestling, especially in general, is just the absurdity of that, right? Like you hit somebody with a steel chair. Like if you, wrestlers actually did this. Like it's not like you could like fake it completely. Like if you're hitting somebody in the head with a chair, you're hitting them with a chair. And that led to all sorts of concussion issues for a lot of guys. But just, you know, how absurd that was, how it's like in real life, I would never do that to someone, right? Even if I were actually, you know, mad at someone, even if we actually got into a fight, it would have to be pretty like intense and like way over the top for me to get to a point where I'd want to smash another human being with a steel chair. But in that game, it was just part of the thing. Like you pick up a chair and smash somebody with it. Yeah, you know, and that's just kind of a joke almost. But yeah, so you know, what do you remember about the Royal Rumble game?
Well, I remember that, alongside NBA Jam, it was probably our most played game. And I think, as you had said earlier, it wasn't 100% representative of how what happened in wrestling, and that, you know, the Royal Rumble is usually comprised of, you know, 30 people or so, but this one had, what did you say, maybe 10 or 12?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
And, but again, you know, we said this about NBA Jam, you know, they whittled it down to two people per team, and it made for a better video game. And similarly, you know, it would be confusing to try to keep track of 30, 16-bit characters in this game. But yes, that aside, I remember I loved going out of the ring and getting that chair and just hitting people over the head with it. It was just, I don't know, it was just entertaining. I mean, it was not a violent thing or anything. It's just, you got to kind of do what the wrestlers did on TV. And so, I think that we, if I remember correctly, we predominantly did the Royal Rumbles and the, I think one-on-one. I don't know that we did a lot of tag teams, but in any case, it was a game that I think didn't have a ton of different options. I mean, again, it had the chair. That was the extent of it. It didn't have like a table that you could jump off the turnbuckle and slam into or anything like that. It didn't, you know, I'm sure you could probably rattle off all the different objects and things that wrestlers have used over the years to defeat their opponents. But, it didn't have steel cage matches built in. It didn't have a lot of fancy things, but what it had was, I think, executed very, very well, especially for the time, and it had all the wrestlers that I liked. So so I think that's why it made for a really good game. And you could probably speak to, I know there were other wrestling games out at the time. I didn't really play many of them, but I would imagine that they had their own little, you know, spin on it, but I think the Royal Rumble did a really good job.
Yeah, you know, and the both of us, I mean, I think, we played video games, especially Super Nintendo, a lot together, but I think that's one thing that, you know, to give listeners a peek behind the curtain here, I think we were, you know, one of the episodes we talked about doing was a video game one, and we decided not, at least for this initial run of episodes, to do it, and part of it is that I think our scope of the games that we were into was pretty limited. Right. Like, I think that we had a few games we played a lot. And I think we each had a couple extra games that we played, you know, more independently. But yeah, even for wrestling games, as much as a fan that I was, you know, I think I probably played like, you know, four or five different ones. But Rumble's the only one I can really remember with any, you know, real certainty. There are little aspects of other ones that I can remember. But that was the one that I was really into, that the only one I think that you and I played much together. And today, you know, I know there's much more advanced games where they've taken like body scans of the wrestlers so they, you know, move like the wrestler and they have a lot more moves kind of built in. But I think there is something to be said for that generation of game where it was a little bit more just kind of button mashing, right? Where it's like, you know, you just press, like, you know, keep punching and kicking somebody, and you hold one button so you can give them a suplex, and then you do this, the whatever signature move is attached to that wrestler, and that's like it. You know, they go outside him with a steel chair a couple more times. But yeah, and I think, you know, it's I think probably objectively not as good a game as some of the ones to follow. But if you pressed me, you've got to sit down and play a wrestling game for a half hour. But no question, I would pick Royal Rumble, any day of the week.
And that's where I wonder. Yeah. You said objectively speaking, and you know, it's so funny because, like, does objectivity even matter then? Yeah, you know, yeah. Because like you said, you know, it's if you had to play a game for half an hour, yeah, like. Give me Royal Rumble, or, you know, in the basketball arena, give me NBA Jam. Like, I don't even want to think about other games, even if I don't care that they have better graphics, they have better moves, they have more accurate moves. I don't care about that. I care about what makes me feel, what's fun and what makes me feel good. And I think that's kind of where these games come in, you know?
Yeah, well, and I think it speaks to, you know, a broader kind of, you know, theory that I have, that I think I think it applies to this whole podcast and why we're both drawn to do it. And I don't 100% agree with myself on this, but I'll still just put it out there, of this idea that there's no real such thing as a guilty pleasure. You like what you like, right? So like wrestling itself, I think as a whole, you know, I often, you know, kind of call it a guilty pleasure. I'm talking, especially, you know, now I'm in academia, now that I'm a professor, like it's a weird thing for me to be into, right? And I think I spend a lot of time in my adult years, especially trying to hide that it's something that I'm so into. But you know, once you kind of own it, I think you realize, like, it's, you like what you like, you enjoy what you enjoy, you know. And that's not to say that it's perfect, that there are pieces of wrestling history that have been, you know, sexist and racist and, you know, otherwise, you know, problematic, but on the whole, I think it's fun entertainment. And I fully understand people who, you know, just can't stomach the violence of it, or who just, you know, think it's dumb and just aren't entertained by it. So be it. I am. Right. And, you know, and I think that again, that's kind of going back to our discussion of Royal Rumble. There are games that are more realistic. There are games with better graphics. There are games that, you know, if you're a serious gamer, probably have, you know, better gameplay in some way or another. But for us, like, I think that's the game, right? Like that, if we're going to play a wrestling game, I don't think either one of us would even consider another game if we were, you know, going to, you know, spend some time doing that.
Yep.
But yeah, you know, and just as one other piece of kind of, you know, a childhood of being into wrestling and being fans, there are the action figures, right, which were such a big thing from the 1980s into the 1990s. And I don't think that you were as into that world. I don't think that you really had you might have had a few of them. I don't think you had like a collection like I did. But I know that my parents, you know, spent some time and some money, gave me a lot of those LGN, you know, the big rubber dolls that, you know, I don't think were very good for play, especially as a little kid, because they were so big and you couldn't remove any arms or legs or anything. But we're kind of, I think that they're so memorable because they're just like art pieces almost. So like little rubber sculptures of all the big stars of the day. So, you know, I had so many of those, but I also had all of these ones that I think they were actually produced in the 1980s, but they were, AWA, dolls or figures. But they were smaller, they were more movable, they were less realistic, but I played with those for years, long past the point when probably a kid should be playing with wrestling figures. I would still break those out sometimes.
Last week.
To have some fun. No. Yeah, as we all did, I think, to some extent. But yeah, anything else in terms of, you know, merchandise or toys or anything like that that you can remember from that era?
Well, first, I do remember those action figures that you talked about, especially those big rubber ones.
Yeah.
And those were actually kind of cool, but you're right. I wasn't really, I like the look and feel of them, but this goes for my entire childhood. Like, I never had like G.I. Joes or anything like, I think I may have had Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle figures, but I never knew what to do with, like, I don't know what you do with them. Like, they were always cool to look at and maybe play with a little bit, but like, I do you kind of like put them together and have them be like in a match with one another, probably?
Because my big thing is I would just get in my head and I would imagine it. And I remember I was like hardcore to the extent that I kept whole notebooks where I wrote down the matches that I was having. So mm-hmm. I have like my own personal like pay-per-view events where I was like bringing stars from different like eras and companies together. And then I would just play out the matches in my head while I was kind of holding them. And like, I think they were just sort of like a platform for me to imagine this stuff.
Well, and that, and that actually makes some sort of sense. I mean, definitely advanced for probably the age you were, I would guess, but like, but most people aren't doing it in that way. And right. So then I still questioned it a little bit, but I know that, I mean, they made a lot of money on those figures. So there clearly was a market for them, and I don't want to downplay that by any means.
Yeah, absolutely. But so, well, I guess well, just, oh no, please go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I wasn't done. No. So no, regarding like merchandise and whatnot, as I said before, I had, you know, the Bret Hart, glasses and I think one Halloween I was Bret Hart and ended up getting, I don't know if there was anything official besides the glasses, but I definitely, you know, dressed up as a child as him for, you know, like I said, for Halloween. But another thing I remember, and it's not really merchandise, but it relates to our childhood. And, I'm sure you remember this. So my birthday, you know, came around every year, in May. And I remember that you would, oftentimes draw a wrestler. You draw my card essentially. Yeah, yeah. So, I remember again, a Bret Hart one, And I think you're a better artist. I mean, not that you fancy yourself an artist necessarily, but let's just say you're more creative than probably a lot of people. And so, I mean, I could definitely tell who you know, which wrestler you were going for. And you did, you know, a pretty good job at the ripe age of whatever, 9 or 10. And so that's just something that has stuck with me. If that's not a testament to how much we connected on the wrestling front, I don't know what is the fact that you.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah. Those cards are. I'd forgotten about that until you mentioned it. But those are at the nexus of living in a family of cheapskates and being a kid who like drew and wrote and all this stuff a lot. Where it's like, well, we don't want to spend money on a card; it's kind of a waste of money. But like, oh yeah, I'll just draw whatever wrestler I think we both like and say happy birthday on it and.
Exactly.
You know, it's whatever.
But it was fine. Yeah, I mean, it was It was better to me. It as much as I'm glad it saved you guys money. But yeah, to me, it was even better because I had an original, piece of work from Mike Chin. You know, and then here I am as a sign of the times, when it came time to get a card, and if we didn't get a chance to go to the store, you know, we would pull something up on our what was it? Pentium one, compute 133, you know, gigahertz computer. And then we print it off on one of the, inkjet printers or I don't even know what they called it anymore. And then you do the double fold thing where you'd fold.
Right. Yeah.
And then you'd end up with a card made out of a piece of computer paper. you know, whereas now you either send an e-card or just write on somebody's wall or actually, yeah. You know,
well, this is the kind of stuff I actually wonder, and I guess, you know, you and I, we're both fathers, but our kids are really small right now, so they're not at the point of, you know, going to birthday parties or, you know, making cards or giving cards or buying cards, whatever, but I do wonder what kids do now, right? Because, like, you know, the technology is better, so if you want to just print out a card, you could probably do a much better job than anything that either I would have done back then. I could see the whole hand-drawn thing if a kid's kind of artsy, you know, but also kind of my default is like, you probably would just buy a card, even though it's silly, even though it's kind of outdated. Like,
yeah, no, then, and I would almost, I don't want to say guarantee, but I think that's what happened. It's cyclical. And so we're back at that, you know, it's like you used to get all this junk mail, right. In your mailbox. And then, over time that shifts and now you get all this spam, which right. is the junk mail version of, you know, whatever of your email inbox. And now when you get physical mail, you're like, oh cool, I wonder what I got, you know, because it becomes the less frequent thing. And and similarly, you know, I would not be surprised at all if you know, enough people had gotten the printed out cards or the digital cards and whatnot, and now it's like oh, I'm gonna circle back and actually start going the physical tangible card route again. And
yeah, so I mean, we'll see. But we're going a little far afield here. We're still at 90s nostalgia pretty squarely, but
yeah.
We'll circle back around to wrestling here. So I want to talk about just, you know, a brief discussion. There's no way we can cover, you know, every wrestler and every match and every event, you know, that happened in the 90s. But I thought we could spend just a few minutes going to, you know, a few of our favorites. So, like, you know, the maybe not even necessarily favorites, but most memorable wrestlers to you from your time as a fan.
So, for me, I mean, obviously, Bret Hart is the top of the list. I mean, if I haven't mentioned him 10 times already, and here I am again. But also Hulk Hogan. I think Hulk Hogan was a very big name across, you know, I mean, it went beyond, you know, state lines, national lines, all of that. Hulk Hogan was incredibly famous, still is. So I would say that those two probably rise above the rest. I mean, there are several, you know, three through N for me. But like, I love the Ultimate Warrior. I thought the Undertaker was always pretty cool. Obviously, you know, Ric Flair was big. You know, as soon as like The Rock started coming around, that's probably, I do like The Rock, and I like his acting and all that, and I think he's entertaining, but that's about the time when I would probably, like anybody after him, I don't think would really make my list of.
Yeah. No, I mean, and there was a shift then. Right. And, you know, I think it's funny. I grew up, my dad never pulled any punches and saying, you know, it's all fake, right? Like, and they don't believe in this, you know, it's all storyline, so on and so forth. You know, and I grew up, you know, you couldn't sort of not be a Hulk Hogan fan, or at least most of us couldn't, you know, not when we were like, you know, really little. And I think, you know, Bret Hart kind of emerged as the new top star at a time when I think I sort of was ready for like an underdog to kind of be the hero. You know, I think it was sort of, you know, I could like Hulk Hogan a lot, but he was like a superhero. I was never going to be Hulk Hogan. I could be Bret Hart, right? Like I'm never going to be a 300-pound guy who can body slam Andre the Giant, but I might be like a 200-pound guy who could really know his technical stuff and outsmart people and then things like that. So, you know, and it's funny, you know, again, with my dad, I remember talking about wrestling and like, and he thought Bret Hart was too small to be believable as, you know, the world champion. And so I told him my favorite was Razor Ramon. And I did like Razor Ramon a lot, especially when he first debuted. But I think as I got a little bit older, I realized like, no, I really kind of like Bret Hart better. Like he's really kind of my guy. And especially, you know, from a more adult lens, you know, you had your story about, you know, giving him high five over the railing, you know, at an event. I went to two separate minor league baseball games in the interest of meeting Bret Hart. The first time the line was too long, and kind of like our Razor Ramon experience, I ended up getting turned away. I ended up kind of tracking down, I jumped to kind of a security line and got to shake his hand really briefly. And I was like, well, at least I got that out of the whole experience. But then found out that he was doing another signing about 3 hours from where I was living at the time. You know, waited a couple hours again, but did actually get to meet him and shake his hand and do a photo with him and get him to sign a copy of his book. But you know, and that's where like, those are the kinds of things like that. That's probably one of my most prized possessions now, just for, you know, the experience of meeting him and how much I liked him as a wrestler, but also just remembering that childhood and kind of how much he meant to us, you know, back in that time. But yeah, you know, and otherwise, you know, I think we both have some fond memories of like that summer when Lex Luger body slammed Yokozuna and they had their big match at SummerSlam. Like it's not very good wrestling in any, again, objective kind of way. Like it's hard to go back and watch that match, I think, unless you're just purely in it for nostalgia. It's not like technically a very, you know, fun match or anything, but you know, it does pack in some memories. You know, and then you know, Sid went by Psycho Sid and Sid Vicious and Sid Justice and all kinds of things. Again, you know, not a guy who I think was all that fun or impressive to watch in the ring, but just in terms of being, you know, a tall, super jacked up dude who just, you know, looked like he was, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it, a badass. I remember, you know, really liking him at the time, and, you know, and Big Van Vader, I think, kind of came along right at the time when I was ready to start rooting for the bad guys sometimes, and I thought he was really cool. So you have these memories of these guys though, where it's, you know, a lot of it's really arbitrary. A lot of it's just, did they look cool at the time, or did they have, you know, that one cool move that kind of stood out? I think that's a big part of why I was so into Razor Ramon for a few years, was the Razor's Edge just looked really cool. You know, but they stick with you though. It's still, you know, a huge point of nostalgia. You know, even as someone who has kept watching it, it's hard for anyone now, in my estimation, to top those guys, even if they're equally talented or more talented. To match up with kind of the iconic status of those guys from our childhood.
Well, and you know, I remember it, speaking of Razor Ramon. I mean, was it a Monday Night Raw that was it the 1-2-3 kid?
Yeah.
Who defeated him? You know, and that's that's a moment that I don't think any of us were expecting.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about underdogs, and so you know, just there's like you said, there's the wrestlers for either the way they look, their one signature move that was really cool. I remember a lot of the wrestlers from WrestleMania 9, and I don't know if that's just because that's one of the first WrestleManias I had seen. Mm-hmm. The big Gonzalez, right? Giant Gonzalez, that's what it was. And he'd wear a suit that was like of a body.
Yeah. The story, I don't know if you know, is that he was just super skinny. Like he didn't have a muscle on him.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It had muscles airbrushed on it to make it look more imposing than he was. But it was obvious that it wasn't really muscle, but it carried the illusion, though, that he was, a bigger guy than he was.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Andre the Giant was just, he just had the fact that he was a giant. I mean, not just the fact, but like.
No, he's literally a giant, though. Yeah.
I mean, he was. And, I heard stories that he could down a handle of Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
The way that everybody else could handle a shot.
Right.
There's definitely quite a few wrestlers over the years that and actually one just surfaced not that long ago. I have a comedian friend on Facebook who he's very clever, and he very frequently posts things that do make you laugh, even if they're kind of small. And he had looked up the net worth of the $1 Million Man, Ted DiBiase. Mm-hmm. And on Celebrity Net Worth or something, it had come up with $1 million. And so he posted a screenshot, and he said, "I don't even know why I looked." So, I mean, that it's just funny to hear that. And I think Ted DiBiase is one of the ones in one of the wrestlers in Royal Rumble too, in WWE.
I think that's
Royal
right. Rumble. Yeah.
So, there's just been so many, and. Also, I just as a side note, I remember a lot of the wrestlers based on the notable types of matches too. Mm-hmm. So like they had the they had steel cage matches, right? And I remember I think in WrestleMania, was it 2 with King Kong Bundy?
Yeah, that was 2. Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was a steel cage match in WrestleMania.
Hogan and Bundy. Too.
Yeah, that's right. Things like, because otherwise I don't know that I would remember a ton from WrestleMania 2. It was in the 80s. Another one that pops into mind, Irwin R. Schyster, IRS.
Yeah.
Right. I feel like there was a briefcase match. Do you remember those?
Well, he carried the briefcase. That was sort of his prop, right? He uses like a weapon.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But I thought that they had a ladder match or a briefcase match or something.
So now they have the Money in the Bank briefcase ladder match. Yeah, which that was invented. The first one of them happened at WrestleMania 20.
So that's well beyond
2005, I think. The DNA of that thing, I think you can mm-hmm. that back to a wrestler just using that as a weapon, carrying it around. Mm-hmm. Totally IRS. Yeah.
Right. So
it does speak to some of the just kind of evolution of thing, and that's part of why I think I've stayed a fan is, we saw the first televised live WWF ladder match when it was Razor Ramon and Shawn Michaels for the Intercontinental Title WrestleMania 10. And now they do these Money in the Bank ladder matches where it's like, let's take this aspect of IRS's character with the briefcase. We'll take the ladder match concept. We'll add, 4 or 5 extra guys in the match. So it's kind of a free for all. And we can trace that back kind of that history. I'll say just to, as one more note, just you mentioned IRS, I think one thing that's rewarding about, kind of staying a fan or at least dropping back in on this world, is seeing the second and third generation wrestlers who've kind of come out of this thing. Because, now IRS is two of his sons are in WWE, but Bo Dallas and more famously Bray Wyatt, who plays this kind of like creepy monster character who's absolutely like the antithesis of what IRS was. That's his son, right? Who's kind of just taking it to the next direction, the next level, has had, I think pretty objectively a more successful career than his dad. That's the next generation. And similarly, Ric Flair's daughter, Charlotte, is a top tier performer. She's heavily featured. And I think she's very good at what she does. And she's incredibly athletic. You know, and just to, you know, be able to trace that, you know, Bret Hart's niece, Jim the Anvil Neidhart's daughter, Natalia, she's been wrestling for quite a while now. She's a veteran at this point, right? She's a long timer. But, you know, to be able to kind of trace those lineages, I think it does kind of pay off, you know, sort of having watched it then and being able to drop in on it now and, you know, see all this kind of evolve. All right, so enough about, you know, the actual experience of watching in the 90s. I wanted to fast forward a little bit before we get into our last couple segments we do every episode. So in 2009, we kind of revisited our wrestling fandom there. So, you know, we had watched together a lot from the kind of early to mid 90s. And then I think, you know, by degrees, you were kind of getting less interested. And I you know, mostly hung out and kept watching wrestling and following it. But you know, so WrestleMania 24 comes around, in 2008. And I, at that point I had, you know, I broken up, actually, no, I was still with my girlfriend actually at that point, but we were really going long distance at that point. So I was kind of on my own adrift kind of in Baltimore. WrestleMania was happening in Florida that year. And I started to kind of muse out like, you know, I could just road trip this out. I could just go to WrestleMania. And like, that was always kind of a dream of mine, for lack of a better way of saying it. Just, I thought that'd be really cool to be there in person for it. But cooler heads prevailed, because I was like, looked it up, and it's like, this is like a 14-hour drive each way, and like, I've got to work on Monday, like this is going to be like a nightmare, you know. No, I'm not going to do it now, but I'm going to do it next year. I decided, you know, WrestleMania 25 is a good round number. It's in Houston, where I've never been. That's kind of fun. I'm just going to plan on going. So I reached out to you, I think, and, you know, and kind of put the feeler out there, was like, you know, what do you say we go to WrestleMania? And you were game for it. I think the fact that we were, you know, both bachelors at that point, and we both, you know, were, you know, had full-time jobs, and, you know, were, you know, not that either of us were rich, but we had, you know, expendable income to a degree. So you know, we agreed to do this random trip to Houston to see WrestleMania 25. So, you know, that was for both of us our first WrestleMania in person. I've been to two other ones since then. But I want to ask kind of, you know, your impressions of being there for, you know, not just WrestleMania, but I guess the whole WrestleMania weekend experience at that point.
Well, I mean, it was much more than just like a bunch of wrestling matches. I mean, it really, as you said, you know, it was the first of something that we did in a lot of respects. Like you said, WrestleMania itself, it was the first time either of us had been to Houston. And my first time in Texas at all.
Yeah, me too.
I ended up flying first class to Houston. I don't think it was my first time flying first class ever, but at the same time as a, let's say, how old was I? I was probably around 24 at the time. You know, the first time I flew first class where I could have a drink and really kind of like enjoy it. And so it kicked off as a really great trip. And then, you know, going there and being able to try some of the local cuisine and again, attend, you know, an event that is so rooted in our, you know, in our friendship and history. I thought that was, you know, it turned out to be an awesome experience, but even if it were a terrible experience, I had such the right attitude going into it, because so many things, were kind of falling in place. And you had, you know, like you said, you had brought it up to me a little while before we actually went, like a year almost in advance. And you, correct me if I'm wrong, you got some special access. You paid for something for the both of us. You really hooked us up with like the hotel and the behind the scenes things.
Well, so help me out here. They had these travel packages. I think they still do whenever the world gets back to normal, and, you know, assuming that WrestleMania goes back to the way that it was, but yeah, they have these whole packages where it's like, you know, you have tickets to WrestleMania, you have tickets to the Hall of Fame induction ceremony the night before, you have tickets to, they call it Access, which is like the thing where you get to wait in line and meet old wrestlers or some of the current guys even, you know, and then it included the hotel and some other odds and ends. I shelled out for the whole thing, in part because it was that whole, you know, this is our first time doing it. This might, for all I knew at that point, be the only time we do something like this. And it was like, you know, let's just do the whole thing. Let's not just like, you know, skimp out and pay the bare minimum to make it sort of happen. Let's just have the full experience. But yeah, and it's one of those things where, you talk to a total non-wrestling fan, someone who just kind of is of our generation, but was never into it. I think they still know what WrestleMania is, at least in some abstract sense. Like, they might not know the, specifics of any matches that happened there or exactly, what it looks like. But they've heard of it, and maybe they've heard of the Royal Rumble. Maybe they've heard of SummerSlam. I think for sure they've heard of WrestleMania. And they might just think, that's just, it's a wrestling show. And that might be all they know about it. But I think something that's so kind of synonymous with, with a whole type of entertainment, just kind of cool to be there. And so, and that's why I really appreciated you kind of keeping an open mind and, kind of indulging. Cause I was hardcore about it. And I think one way or another, I was going to go, but like you said, having a friend from childhood who we'd experienced some of these, shows on TV, decades before, it made it, I think, really special. Kind of put it on the next level. And I would actually go so far as to say, I don't think it was a very good WrestleMania. Objectively speaking, I actually would put it in probably like my bottom, there's been 36 of them now. I would say off the top of my head, bottom 10 for sure, somewhere in that ballpark. But I'm almost glad that was the case because it was just such an awesome experience in general that it didn't need to be a good WrestleMania. So if there had to be a not so great one, I'm almost glad it got out of the way that time because I was going to have a great time either way.
Right, right. And by the way, I you say how great it was to have a friend from your childhood come along and everything like that. And I mentioned it 2 minutes ago, but, I think you covered most of the cost of that trip. Again, I had the travel and everything like that, but after that you were the one, I mean, like you said, you were hardcore about it and that made me want to even go more because, I just knew it was going to be a great experience. Like you said, despite the fact that maybe it wasn't the best objective, WrestleMania. But I am appreciative of that. And, yeah. And actually, if we do another one, like the next one's on me. but yeah. And I should also mention not that you asked this, but, that was a transitional time in my life too. Because I was just on the brink of starting a new job. I think WrestleMania was, I could actually tell you within a week's time, it was sometime in early April of 2009. I don't know if it was April 4th or 5th or maybe, no, actually a little bit before that. It was either late March or early April because I literally started this new job and moved my entire life, I think on April 8th. And I knew I was going to come back from our WrestleMania experience and then kind of start a new path. So for so many reasons, that was really a memorable experience. For
yeah,
sure.
just a really cool time. And again, I don't want to bore with all the details, but it happened to be the year that Stone Cold Steve Austin gets inducted in the Hall of Fame. So if you're going to be there for, one Hall of Fame ceremony, that's a pretty big one. That's kind of, a cool thing to have been there for. We got to meet Roddy Piper and Nick Bockwinkle, Harley Race, and a bunch of other, kind of legends of the business at the Access thing. So it's just a really cool experience. I've been to a couple WrestleManias since then that I think were, better WrestleMania shows in and of themselves. But I don't know if the experience is ever going to match that first time and, in the time that we had in Houston there. Let's kind of wrap up our episode now. We'll go to our last two, segments here. So each of our episodes, we're talking a little bit about, whether something would work today. And sort of like when we did the basketball episode, wrestling is still happening. As I've mentioned time and again, I'm still a fan. I still watch on a pretty regular basis. So wrestling itself has obviously continued. It still can work. But it has changed a fair bit. There's a lot of elements that were in play in the 90s that are, not in play in the same way or just are totally gone at this point. So I've got a few points outlined for us here. And if, you have other ideas, feel free to, bring them in as well. But the first one I thought of was, Hulk Hogan always winning, which, was a thing from the mid-80s until, like, you know, early 1992, and then he picked up a little bit again with a short return to the what was then the WWF and then his WCW run, but where he was the good guy who just beat everybody, right? So, you know, stretching back to the 80s, you know, he beats King Kong Bundy, he beats Andre the Giant, he beats, going to the 90s, Earthquake, you know, and so at the time, that was super satisfying, right? Because it's just, he was like my favorite wrestler. I wanted to see him win. And sure enough, you know, it was sort of predictable how it would happen. He would get beat down for a while, then he would Hulk up, and then he would enter a full-on state of Hulkamania, and he would hit the big boot on somebody, leg drop them, get the 1, 2, 3. I don't know that would work today, though, particularly in kind of our snarkier kind of, you know, era right now, where social media is such a thing. You know, the kind of Hogan's spiritual successors, guys like John Cena and now Roman Reigns, got a lot of pushback, right? Because it was like, he's not that good. Like, you know, he's like the chosen one to be like the face of the company, and kids love him, but, you know, he's not that great of an actual wrestler, and people kind of, you know, push back against it. I don't know that the having like the superhero like Hogan on top, and specifically the fact that he won so much, would really fly in 2020. I don't know if you have any thoughts about kind of that sense of, again, just kind of the overwhelming hero and kind of him always winning, if that would still work.
You know, I honestly don't know, because I'm not as familiar with present day wrestling to know how that would play out. But your rationale behind what you believe makes a lot of sense why it might not these days. Yeah. You know, but I'll tell you, growing up and when Hogan was big for me, you know, like you said, kids loved him and looked up to him, you know, and he was the face of the company or organization. You know, when I think about wrestling and in so many aspects, I see a lot of parallels to basketball. And again, going back to, you know, we had talked in our basketball episode about the Bulls winning so much in the 90s. And it was really easy to be a Bulls fan because you could support a winning team. And, you know, and with Hogan, you know, the All-American, and, you know, he was just, yeah, always winning, and he was in great shape. And I remember seeing a couple of, like, quote unquote wrestling videos where he was actually showing how to, like, make, like, nutrition drinks and stuff like that. And pretty much he was behind a blender putting in bananas and who knows what, but it's just like, you know, like you wanted to then make one if you were a kid. You're like, oh, it's going to make me big and strong. Yeah. And so, you know, it's just weird. Like, had I been an adult like I am now back then, I don't know how I would have felt about Hogan. Or if I were a child today, I don't know how I would feel. So I guess all that to say that, you know, I still don't know for sure, but I do think that there's probably a few different factors. It's not just him winning or not winning all the time. It's where you are and what you perceive too, in your life.
No, and I think part of what you're hearing, which I think is a smart point, is, you know, we compare it to, you know, more legitimate sports like basketball. You know, if there's a dynasty in basketball, it's kind of cool to be a part of that, right? When it's like your home team or a player you followed his whole career or whatnot. And I think that's one of the differences now with wrestling, where it's, you know, more acknowledged that it's not, you know, a legitimate sport. The outcomes are predetermined. It's all scripted, so on and so forth. Where there's a little bit more rejection, like when Ronda Rousey was, like, you know, kicking everyone's butt in MMA, you know, not everyone loved her, but you had to kind of respect it, because it's like, well, she won the fight, like she has just beaten all of these people legitimately. Whereas, you know, Hogan wins a wrestling match, it's like, well, okay, but you're telling me he really would take Andre the Giant in a fight? I don't think so, you know. And so yeah, you know, there's a little bit more arbitrary kind of, you know, creative input on it, I guess, that people can, you know, accept or reject, which I think is a little bit of a difference there. But the next thing I had on was skipping ahead to the late 90s, which again, I think you had, this is towards the very end of your fanhood, or maybe even after you were really, you know, following it very much. But, you know, we have the Attitude Era, where, you know, we have a lot of more over the top violence, people getting thrown off the top of steel cages, people, you know, doing chair shots, you know, multiple times throughout a show, you know, right to the head. We have more sexualized content. We have Sunny, and then we have Sable, you know, coming out in bikinis and, you know, teases that they're going to lose their tops and things like that, bra and panties matches, all that kind of stuff that So I'll be pretty straightforward here. I don't think it lands well today. And I think it's telling that WWE, you know, by degrees kind of let a lot of those things go. In the violence part of it, it's a safer product now, right? There's still some of the bells and whistles. They still do some, you know, big stunts and whatnot. But they're very concussion conscious, for example, you know, and then they're all, so there's no, you know, chair shots to the head anymore, or has to be a very specific circumstance when they would do something like that. There's no blading where they intentionally bleed, again, unless it's a very, you know, exceptional, you know, special permission kind of situation. And in terms of the more sexual content, it's much more PG at this point. Like it's not, you know, cut on the cusp of that kind of R rating. And B, I think the female athletes are treated with a great deal more respect, where they're actual, you know, wrestlers now. A women's match actually main evented WrestleMania 35. And it wasn't that forced. So some people have some degree of debate over that. But I think they deserved that spot. It was actually, you know, there's a fair argument that was going to be the best match of the show. I don't think it ended up being the best, but it's more an equal standing now. So there've been a lot of changes since then. But by the same token, there's a lot of people who still hold on to that Attitude Era nostalgia, right? Like I say Stone Cold Steve Austin, and even if you weren't a fan, you have a picture in your head of who that is. I say things like The Rock, D-Generation X, Triple H, by degrees, these things are less famous or, you know, less kind of, universally celebrated or whatnot, but still there's a fair chance that people have some memory of, you know, someone in their high school hallway going, oh, you didn't know? And, you know, they had the whole D-Generation X kind of routine. So I don't know. And I'm curious about your perspective, again, as someone who hasn't been, you know, as enmeshed in this and kind of following it all along. That more edgy product, what you kind of make of it as someone who, you know, wasn't as invested in it, and kind of, you know, how that looks now, if we think that still, you know, would resonate, or if they're right to kind of move away from that kind of angle.
You know, I have mixed feelings on that, because, you know, I think it would resonate today with the greater population in the world? No, I don't. I think that the way that it sounds like it moved is the way that I think is a more socially accepted way of conducting their business. But on the other hand, having gone to a WrestleMania with you, and again, we're adults at that point. I'm not talking about those couple of events we talked about where we went as children. Having gone to a WrestleMania as adults, you know, I saw a lot of the fans, and I'm not sure a lot of those fans cared so much about like the fact that, you know, like it, the more violent, the better, you know, that had that kind of attitude, you know. I you don't want anybody to get injured, but again, I feel like a lot of them may not have minded that somebody got hit in the head five times with a chair, or that they did the intentional, what did you say? Blading,
blading
or whatever. Yeah. Because, you know, blood. Yeah. Okay. You know, it's not that these are violent people, but like it, whether or not you agree with it, obviously it provides some level of entertainment. And if the audience isn't particularly offended by any of those things, then, you know, in that respect, I don't think that moving away from those I don't know that it would help or hurt the organization. Obviously for the wrestlers and like for the women, you know, being respected more and being, chosen to be one of the headline events, like I think you said, for WrestleMania 35. Like if that's something that they were pushing for and they felt like they weren't getting prior to that, then absolutely it's a good direction to head in. But I guess from their fans' perspective, I just don't know. Part of me just thinks that it could have continued the way it was, but another part of me thinks like, oh, maybe it was getting a bit out of hand.
There's something to what you're saying there in terms of just the idea that, you know, if you're someone who's going to a wrestling event, like it's not like you're like, I hope nobody gets hit tonight. like
right
to see people get hit, right? And so and some of it's kind of that fun, you know, the attitude era of like, oh, he got thrown into a dumpster and then they threw it off the side of the stage and they set fire to it. Awesome, right?
Like, yeah, right, yeah,
outlandish, you know, the things that they would do. But yeah, and I would suggest there's an element, you know, today of more like look at how remarkable this athlete is. Like there's guys like I'm sure these are names that are like likely is not familiar to you, but like Mustafa Ali and Rick Jay, who just do ridiculous like you know 450 flips off the top.
Acrobatics, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Where it's like, well yeah, that's legitimately impressive. Like, you know, I don't care if it's scripted or not, I couldn't do that. So I think that they've leaned into that element of it more of like this is an athletic exhibition, you know, closer to like figure skating than to like legitimate MMA in some ways.
But I'll say that might not. Oh, I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
No, please go ahead.
Well, the thing though is that, so that may be completely true and it does sound like that's what they've leaned into, but it's, when you talk about entertainment, is it that seeing something that's impressive is more entertaining, or is it seeing, you know, Bam Bam Bigelow come out and all these flames, you know, on his clothes and on his head tattooed in his head, or like, you know, or Doink coming out in a clown costume? I mean, that is also entertainment. So it's right. Like, where do you get your entertainment fix from? Do you get it from being impressed by the athleticism, or do you get it from seeing, like, you know, people in essentially costumes, you know, or like, you know, Jake the Snake coming out with an actual snake around his neck? I mean, like, regardless of the athleticism, I understand exactly what you're saying about the kind of direction they've headed in, but it's like, but there's different ways that people, you know, feel about entertainment in general.
Yeah. No, and that's where, you know, and the character stuff and the storyline stuff is still there. You know, I think some people would argue that that's, you know, equally prominent as it's ever been. But I think that there is something to what you're saying, just in the sense of, you know, the stuff that appealed about the Attitude Era, the more sexualized stuff, the more over-the-top violence with weapons and things like that, I think caters to a pretty specific audience that, you know, it's like, you know, stereotypically speaking, but I think the stereotype tends to hold up, like teenage boys, right? Which was exactly kind of the target audience for a lot of that stuff in that era. That I don't know it holds up as well for, you know, the kids who grew up, you know, like, so in our generation, you know, your kids, you love Hulk Hogan and the Macho Man, you become a teenager and Stone Cold and the NWO are in vogue. And now you're an adult and you can watch, you know, Charlotte Flair, Ric Flair's daughter, you know, and this next generation of stars who are, you know, more athletic and you have better endurance and things like that, but, you know, don't lean into the violence. You know, there's not really a lot in the way of, you know, more sexualized storylines, anything like that. You know, it's, you know, there are exceptions, but in large part, you know, when my son's a few years older, I would feel reasonable about introducing him to it in a way that I don't think I'd feel reasonable introducing him to the Attitude Era until he's like a teenager or older, you know? So I think those are some of the differences, but you're right that ultimately it comes down to, you know, entertainment and which demographics, I guess, you're trying to appeal to. But the next thing on my list was just this, you know, the pay-per-view business, because that was such a thing in the 90s. You know, it was the WWF had, you know, its four core pay-per-views and they expanded to five, and then it just kind of, you know, continued to grow from there. WCW was more aggressive sooner, where they went to like a roughly once a month model, you know, earlier, and then WWF kind of followed suit on that. And there were times, like, because that model carried on throughout, you know, the 2000s into the 2010s. And as a full-grown adult, again, who was kind of, you know, bachelor with expendable income, I bought the pay-per-views sometimes, right? Like not every single month, but, you know, I would say at least two or three times a year, I would shell out for it. I can't imagine doing that now. And then the reason is that now that there are these streaming services, WWE Network in particular, where it's I pay my $10 a month, and I get access to all the pay-per-views, right? So, and this is going a little bit, you know, insider and in today's wrestling, but there's a newer promotion that's been around for about a year now, All Elite Wrestling, that, you know, has a TV deal with TNT, has some money behind them, has some big names, but they still do conventional pay-per-view, where they, you have to pay like $50 to watch one of their big shows. And time and again, I've been tempted by it, because it's like, this looks like a really good show. I'd be excited to see this, but I can't do it. because it's just that the idea that like I'm already paying my $10 a month and getting, you know, this kind of, you know, infinite backlog of content and the new pay-per-views from WWE. I can't pay $50 for a single show that's going to last like 3 hours now. But I don't know if you, please.
Well, the thing you can't because of the alternative, which is this wonderful streaming service that's only $10 a month.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing. It's just the number of options that are available these days. You have kind of rendered, yeah, pay-per-view obsolete, but it's really tough because, you know, that idea beforehand wasn't so crazy. You said you shelled out a couple times a year for those pay-per-view events. And I, you know, to tell you the truth, I don't know if they do that with boxing still or not, but boxing was another one too. Mm-hmm. You know, if you had a big Tyson fight coming up or something, and you either went to a bar that happened to have paid for it and you catch the big fight there or MMA, right. Yeah. Or you shelved out it was expensive. I don't know, $50, $60, $100 sometimes,
yeah.
for the pay-per-view. But if I broaden it a little bit more or take a step back, I should say, you know, would I pay $50 or $100 for something that I'm super into and that I think I would get a lot of value out of? Yeah, absolutely. Right. The cost itself isn't the factor necessarily, but absolutely. When you start bringing in the fact that you have, and you know, this is relatively new to me. You only told me within the past year or two that you had, I think it was maybe about, it was like a year or two ago that you told me that you paid for this streaming service with wrestling, and that there's just so much content available for consumption. And that sounds, for $10 a month, it sounds wonderful. And then completely obsoletes the pay-per-view thing. Like why would you get 5 months out of the streaming service before you got, you know, for the same cost that it would cost you for 1 3-hour event on pay-per-view.
Right.
So, regarding whether, it would work today. Yeah, clearly not. You know, we've gone as a society to the streaming model. And another thing I've noticed with the streaming too, is that a lot of, and not so much with wrestling, but, you know, a lot of stuff is released all at once too.
Right.
You know, there's not this like concept of having to wait for things as much. And, I have mixed feelings on whether or not I think that's a good thing, because it kind of feeds into our, you know, immediate gratification kind of mentality a lot of times. And I'm victim of it too, or I'm guilty of it, I should say. We want what we want fast. We want it now. We want it to not cost an arm and a leg. We're starting to get all of that, you know, like services are starting to provide us all of that. And wrestling is no exception. And so, but what I want to know is, where do we go from here?
Now, have you heard of the Peacock?
I don't think so.
So it's NBC's new streaming service, which I'm really interested to see how this goes for them, because they have three tiers of it. They have a free tier, which I think is the most interesting part of it, where they have, or I don't know if it's completely rolled out, but by the time this episode airs, I'm pretty confident it will be out there. But it's just, you know, a tier where there's a ton of content. It's totally free. A lot of old NBC shows and some movies and things like that. And then they have like a $5 tier where there's commercials, but you unlock a ton more stuff. And then I think a $10 level where it's all the stuff, no commercials. Which I think it's a pretty interesting kind of balance of strike there, right? Because at minimum, it's like, if you do the free version, you're not losing anything. Like, you can just, you know, watch this stuff, and yeah, there's commercials, but like, that's like old TV, what it would have been. But then, you know, it's that individual tiers. And like for Hulu, for example, they have sort of a similar deal where, you know, we have a relatively low level of it where, you know, we have to watch commercials through most of the shows, but we still get to watch shows on it. But with NBC, I'm really curious how this plays out for them with the tier thing, and if we might see other companies start to move in that direction as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. But to your point, you know, people start to realize, oh, wait, I could just get everything I want and just have to watch some commercials like the old times, like you wonder how successful it's going to be. Is anybody going to pay for that $10 tier? Or maybe they will go either free or $10 and not pay for the
$5 tier. Right. Part of what makes me wonder though about it is that, this speaks to, maybe my wife and I not doing the best job in all of our parenting, but our son, is watching some TV now, and there's a YouTube channel he really likes, but we're not paying for any premium stuff for anything. He loses his mind when commercials come on. Cause like I'm enjoying my program and they do it really abruptly too, where it's not like a natural break. It's just like in the middle of the video, all of a sudden it's like 30 seconds of commercials where he's just like screaming. He's like, what? I was watching my show. And he doesn't have the words to say that, but
you're going to pay $20 for the ultra, whatever.
Like this generation that never had to deal with commercials, especially this youngest generation, like my son, like your kids. I wonder if it's just going to be like, wait, I have to sit here and watch some advertisement for something. No, $5, $10 to get rid of that. I wonder. I don't know if that's how it'll be.
Yeah. And I don't think, I don't think it's necessarily strictly your parenting or, it's like the generation it's partly the generation where the technology is. My daughter is, knows how to do all the swiping on phones and things like that. And it's like, that's kind of scary. We didn't even have, that's the thing. When we grew up, I'm not even sure cell phones were around, in the earliest days, definitely not anything with a swipe. Not even with an LCD screen or anything. So, back to my point though, it'll be interesting to see how things progress from here. I really want to know what the next kind of direction is for that any of these services take,
So I led us a little far afield on that one. So to circle back to wrestling, one more, what would it work today thing of just this concept of kayfabe, which, for casual fans, you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. So I'll give the briefest explanation I can think of, which is basically kayfabe imagines that wrestling is real. So all the storylines are real. All the characters are real. You're just watching real people and real fights. In the 80s and earlier, that was how wrestling worked. They tried to quote unquote protect the business, where they went so far as some promotions, they said if somebody picks a fight with you, you fight them and you win, in order to prove that wrestling is legitimate and you legitimately are this professional athlete who would kick anybody's butt. And then we go into the late 80s, early 90s, they loosen the reins on that a little bit, especially as the big characters start coming out. WWF in some interviews acknowledges no, it's in a form of entertainment. They don't come out and say that it's fixed, but there's kind of a wink and a nod and acknowledgement that obviously this isn't, entirely real. Nowadays though, it's so blown open. There's new podcasts that drop virtually every day. With wrestlers talking about behind the scenes information and what it was really like to do something, especially among the older guys who've retired and aren't really in the business anymore. But even among current stars, they'll do this stuff. Like Chris Jericho, who is still actively wrestling. He has a podcast where on a weekly basis, I think twice a week even, he interviews other wrestlers, and they talk very openly about storylines and how they came about and mechanics of how wrestling works in a way that no one would have done back in the day. I'm eager to hear if you have any thoughts on this, because again, if you were only enmeshed in that world when they did protect kayfabe a little bit more and didn't pull back the curtain. But it's almost impossible to imagine a world now where you would keep kayfabe all the time, because now everyone's on Twitter, everyone's on Instagram. You see guys posting pictures of themselves at the beach, and it's like, wait, I thought you were a swamp cult leader. I didn't know you had, a child and a wife and all this stuff. And it's like, well, now we acknowledge, you're an actor who plays a swamp cult leader on TV. You might still look like you do. You might still be physically impressive, but that's not who you really are. You're a real person. So we can kind of, separate those things out. But I was curious if you have any thoughts on kind of that dynamic, because I think it is an interesting one, shifted a lot.
I think, again, kind of like what I had said previously, it really depends on, do I have a thought on it as an adult now? Yeah, I agree with you that there's way too many communication channels to try to stay, in character, so to speak, or do stay kayfabe? Like, what's the?
Yeah.
I guess
people use it all kinds of ways. That's fair. Yeah.
You know, so understandably, you know, and especially with podcasts and everything. So, understanding there's a distinction there as an adult, like, yeah, I'm totally cool with that. And it is interesting to hear kind of like how they act and what they do in character and what, and how they feel kind of behind the scenes or whatever.
Yeah.
And hearing their stories. But again, I will say as a child, I think that was kind of important to protect it. I really do, because, you know, that's kind of what we knew and what we aspired to. Like, I don't, you know, if I'm looking up to, you know, Hulk Hogan or Bret Hart or something like that, and then in real life, I find out that they, you know, they did something that I wasn't a really big fan of.
Hulk Hogan's a huge racist.
Right. Yeah. For example, you know, like that's, I don't know. I feel like that could really have an impact on me. And in a weird way, it's, again, I don't want to deter too much from wrestling, but it's kind of like, you know, like your third grade teacher, fourth grade teacher. I mean, you know your teacher from the classroom, right? And it's always weird when you're like in the mall and you see them with their husband or wife, and you see them, you know, like, you know, like what they're buying or whatever. Yeah. It's just, it's like, no, I see you in a professional setting, but like, you know, they're wearing professional clothes. They're teaching us math or science or something like that. You know, it's like, it's weird to see them out of, the typical setting that you expect them to see them. And a little bit, not quite to this level, you know, if you go to Disney World and, you know, you see, you know, Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse and all the different Disney characters. And then you go, you know, to use the bathroom and you see one of them with their costume or the head of their costume off or something. Right. And it's like, wait, you're not, you're somebody else too.
I think that's a good example because, you know, intuitively, you know, that's not actually a giant mouse. Right.
Right. Right.
But at the same time, you don't quite get to the point of like, well, yeah, this is a person who's got the mouse head just sitting on the ground next to them, smoking a cigarette. You know, you don't necessarily want that image in there, you know, and there's something I grapple with this too. You know, you mentioned the teacher example, you know, as a college professor now, you know, I have a good, you know, 75 to 100 students come through my classroom each semester. And I also have a pretty active presence on Twitter. Like I tweet about pro wrestling, I tweet about literature, I tweet about, you know, pop culture kind of stuff. And I've got some of my students have found me there who are following me now. And it is kind of a weird line to draw of, you know, that whole, I'm sort of a role model and I'm also sort of like a, you know, a professional figure. You know, and I stand by, you know, kind of my social media presence. I don't think I post anything I'm, you know, ashamed of to the extent I'd lose my job or, you know, it would really be problematic for me. But it does make me think for a second of like, huh, so now they realize that like I spend like, you know, hours a week thinking about wrestling based on my Twitter output. What does that do to my image as like a serious scholar that they previously had? I don't know, you know, but with wrestlers, you know, now being out there, yeah, it does kind of, you know, break any illusions you might have, and it kind of merges those worlds.
Well, and regarding your most recent example there, you know, I a lot of times the answer is, well, you try to find the best balance, you know, like balance seems to be kind of a big thing in trying to, you know, protect the scholarly, you know, aspect of you in terms of like, you know, your image, and then also wanting to share with the world things that you love. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that at all. Mm-hmm. However, I do wonder if, I literally don't know, but like, I wonder what if it ever makes sense to just choose a side, you know? Mm. Because I think there are people that do that
yeah.
are, right, like, so like they are completely 100% concerned about their image and make sure only what they put out is what they want the world to see at any given point. And not that like you said, you're not ashamed of anything that you put out, but I'm thinking about like there are plenty of prominent figures that just won't go on social media at all.
Right.
Like they don't tweet, they don't do Facebook. They don't do anything. So, you know, all that people know about them is what they see on TV or read about in the paper. And then there's people completely on the other end that literally don't like
they broadcast their lives.
Right. Exactly. Minute by minute. They don't, not that they don't care, but that's the approach that they're taking. And I would guess most people probably fall somewhere kind of in the middle.
Well, yeah, I mean, to tie that back to wrestling for a second, I mean, I think The Undertaker is kind of the prime example of that, where up until the last couple of years, he had no social media presence. And he went to the extreme of like the Hall of Fame ceremony, where everybody's there, like past, present, you know, future. They're all, you know, there in the crowd to, you know, watch the ceremony. He would stay backstage because he wasn't in character. And so he didn't want to be seen by the fans out of character. So to like really kind of like wonky extremes, even he would do it. And now it's rumored that he's retired. He has sort of said that he is officially retired. There's a lot of speculation that he's not really done. So it's kind of a funky in between space for him now. But he is now on social media, and that's kind of the big shift. Like, I think most recently, as of a recording of this, I guess in the last couple of days, he got on TikTok. Which is just,
of course, sort of, he did,
you know, for a guy who never did social media, who, you know, everyone calls him Undertaker, no one calls him by his real name. Even, you know, JBL, who was a colleague of his, who the Undertaker was in his wedding, he was a groomsman. And he said, I remember an interview where he said very, very frankly, like, no, I call him the Undertaker. I don't care that he was my groomsman, he's the Undertaker, that's what I call him. He was chastising someone else who tried to call him Mark or Mark Calloway by his real name, and say like, no, put some respect on his name. He's the Undertaker. It's just kind of wild, you know, the lengths that this stuff goes to. But yeah, I think to your point that there is that interesting spectrum. I would argue that the Undertaker went from one extreme to the opposite extreme all of a sudden. And that abrupt shift, I don't know that I love it, but we'll see how that all plays out.
But
all right, let's wrap this up. We've kept our listeners long enough, I think. So we'll kind of motor through our last segment here, which is our draft segment. So we did this for our kind of NBA starting team. We did this for movies that we would watch along with American Pie in a previous episode. So the challenge I've given us here is I've drawn together a list of about somewhere 20 to 30 or so of the biggest names of the 1990s in professional wrestling. I'm going to ask us each to draft our own five-man Survivor Series team. So if you're really rusty on your wrestling fanhood, or you're just humoring us by listening and you really never really followed it, the idea is every November is kind of a Thanksgiving tradition that they would do the Survivor Series. They still do it now, where the main concept is four or five-man teams going up against each other, elimination matches. So just, you know, you lose one guy, you lose another guy, the last man standing, or last team standing wins the match. So that's kind of the concept we're working with here. But beyond that, it's pretty wide open. So we can pick, you know, based on who we thought the greatest were, who we think are the best, who our personal favorites were, you know, anywhere along that spectrum. So I'll give it to you once again, especially because I think I kind of have home court advantage on this one, having watched wrestling a lot more, that I'm going to go ahead and give you the first pick if you want to pick for your team.
Okay, so I appreciate that. The first person I guess I would pick would have to be Bret Hart.
Yeah.
I mean, you probably knew that. Just one of my favorite wrestlers, a great wrestler, probably, not that I've ever been to Calgary, Alberta, Canada, but, you know, I would guess probably one of the biggest names to come out of Canada. And just, I've seen him wrestle so many different times, and having been such a huge fan of him throughout the time that I really watched wrestling in earnest, he's got to be my number one pick.
Yeah, no, I think between objective talent and between our personal preferences, he would have been my first pick too. So I bet. So I'm going to go, if you're going to pick Shawn Michaels, I'm going to stick with our Survivor Series theme here. I'm going to pick Shawn Michaels as my...
If I'm going to pick Bret Hart, you're going to pick Shawn Michaels?
Oh, excuse me, I flipped that. Yeah, but so if you're going to pick Bret Hart, yeah, I'm going to pick Shawn Michaels here. Longtime rivals, both on air and off air, and particularly at Survivor Series. They had, was it only three or four separate matches at Survivor Series itself, captaining teams, And then one-on-one matches, ultimately culminating in Bret Hart leaving the company when the Montreal screw job happened, which is a whole nother thing I'm not going to get into in this particular podcast. If you're interested, Google it. You will find no shortage of resources about it. But went down to Survivor Series 1997, the last match the two of them ever happened, which happened at a Survivor Series. So in any event, Shawn Michaels, I think, not my personal favorite, but I think very arguably one of the greatest of all time. And particularly at Survivor Series, he had a lot of great performances there. So I think that adds an extra little edge that he'll be my first pick.
Nice. My next pick would probably be, Ric Flair.
Yeah.
I mean, granted he's a bit older, but, you know, he's been around for a while, but just, I feel like he had a really, solid wrestling career. Really well known. You know, the figure four leg lock, I've seen him put it, so many people in it, and he just, he was just always, I feel like a solid wrestler. And just the longevity of his career just still astounds me. I mean, you could tell me right now that he's still wrestling. I know you talked about his daughter, but you could tell me he's still wrestling, and I wouldn't really be too surprised.
Yeah, I think he's finally probably for the best of everyone. Yeah, but you know, in 1993, he leaves WWF. He goes to WCW again. Where that was always kind of his home base, the NWA/WCW. But at that point he's in his mid-40s, and one of the big storylines is that he's so old, like he's too old, like he's kind of washed up, like can he still do it? He wrestles another 15 years after that. In 2008 he has his kind of unofficial retirement. He works what's billed as a retirement match at WrestleMania. He went on to work some other matches outside of WWF, kind of in smaller companies like TNA and other independent places. But I think, you know, a lot of people would consider that kind of that's where the story ends, is 2008. But yeah, you know, and throughout the 90s, he remained, you know, a figure, and, you know, so someone who had to kind of respect it in that realm. So I think that absolutely makes sense.
And actually, again, not to draw a parallel with our basketball episode, but like in a weird way, like he's the Robert Parrish of wrestling in my book.
Like, yeah, and actually, I think that's a deceptively good comparison. I think Flair peaks higher than Parrish. Like there's a time when you could call Ric Flair the greatest, if not of all time, at least of that generation. But he also has another, you know, those last, you know, 10 years or so of his career, he's not the old Ric Flair. Like occasionally he can turn it out, but by and large, he does kind of come to seem like an old guy who's, you know, kind of playing the greatest hits and isn't really there anymore. Robert Parrish went from being, you know, a legitimate starting center on championship teams to being like a mentor figure, right? Like he's valuable to have on the team because he can help younger guys learn their craft. But no one's really taking him that seriously as a starter anymore. So,
right. Yeah, exactly.
But all right, you've got Bret Hart and Ric Flair on your team so far. I've got Shawn Michaels. I'm going to add on Steve Austin. I think that, you know, in terms of guys who are explosively over in the 90s, you know, he burned bright and burned out faster than Hulk Hogan did. Hogan, you know, remained relevant to top guy for, you know, most of kind of two decades, really. Austin was really only like the guy, like burning white hot for a good, like 5 or 6 years there. But when he was hot, that there was no one hotter, I think, ever in the history of the business. And he was a better, I think, mechanical performer than Hogan ever was, than a lot of guys. In fact, you know, I would put Bret Hart, Ric Flair, Shawn Michaels above him. The list might end there. Like there's not very many other guys I would put decisively above, Steve Austin as an in-ring performer. So, elite in that way as well. And just a great character. Not the greatest guy outside the ring necessarily. He had some domestic violence issues that I'm not going to, you know, go too far deep in here. So I'm acknowledging that. I'm not kind of trying to forgive that, but for the purposes of this discussion, he'll be my number two pick.
And you know, you said one of the best in the ring, you know, so are you speaking in terms of like athletic ability?
Yeah. So and in his case specifically, more technical ability and ability to kind of put them together. Like the one thing I'll argue is if you were to just sit down and watch a random Hulk Hogan match from the 90s right now, you know, nostalgia would seep in. It'd probably be fun. But it's hard to say, like, oh wow, like I'm awed by what he can do. Like it's sort of like, you know, if I trained for a couple months, I bet I could more or less do that. Not the power stuff. I'm never going to be as big as Hogan was, but you know, but mechanically, I think I could do most of that. If you take a Steve Austin match and just the pace he would cut, you watch some, especially his matches with The Rock, and some of those other kind of main event style matches, he just runs into the ring and starts throwing punches and kicks. And the cardio that has to take, it is impressive in its own right. And then he could also do the more technical stuff. In terms of like, you know, win-loss records, I don't put much stock in that because, you know, it's all predetermined. But in terms of, you know, what he could do to put on an entertaining physical show, I think that there were few who were better. Not for flying around the ring, not for doing flips, but for just, you know, kind of knowing how to manipulate bodies and put on a what looked like a convincing fight.
Right. So speaking of kind of athletic abilities and convincing fights and things like that, I'm inclined to pick The Rock next. Just again, I mean, you know, he I think he got his start in wrestling right before he became a much bigger actor and things like that, but
yeah
he had I feel like physically he was always pretty pretty solid there, and I'm not familiar with everybody that he's ever wrestled, but again, you know, I look at him now and I know, you know, about his physique and everything like that, and I don't know, I just kind of would want him on my team.
I think it's a great pick, and you know, and yeah, he's a third generation wrestler, so his grandfather on his mother's side was a wrestler, and then his dad was a wrestler. And then he took up the family business, and he's part of the Inoue family, which is sort of this sprawling wrestling family where anyone basically with any kind of Samoan heritage probably belongs to that family. Like Roman Reigns now, Rikishi was part of that family. The Wild Samoans, kind of up and down the line, there's dozens of these guys who have some relation to each other. But The Rock was undeniably the biggest star out of any of them. I think one of the greatest talkers in the business. No one could match him in terms of charisma, and a good worker in the ring. I don't think that you would hold him up as like a Bret Hart or a Ric Flair in terms of, you know, he's going to put on like these classic athletic performances that, you know, kind of awe you technically, but knew how to do it all. I think he melded kind of just the right amount of technical stuff with the charisma and the character stuff to be unforgettable. And yeah, as you said, it springboards this movie career where, I wouldn't call Rock the biggest wrestling star of his generation or of all time, but in terms of wrestlers who crossed over and became celebrities, I don't know that I would call anyone more famous than him now, right? I think he has become he's more than transcended the business. He's the biggest guy to have come out of wrestling in that way. So cool. So for my next pick, I'm going to go with the Macho Man, Randy Savage. So just in terms of guys who, you know, we're right there, where we're kind of, you know, right alongside, you know, Hogan is kind of biggest stars of that era, but also kind of, like I said, for Austin, the matches hold up. Like, you go back and watch his stuff. And especially for a guy who came up in the 80s, a lot of those guys are all sizzle and no steak, so to speak, where they have big characters, you know, big personas, but you know, they don't actually do anything that impressive. That guy got some serious height on that flying elbow drop, and the flying accidentals that he would do. And one of my favorite elements of him, he marks this very specific category of guys who you don't know if they're legitimately crazy. He was just so intense, and he so played with that line of like real life, like, you know, altercations with Hogan and some other people, where you just don't know if this guy actually would fly off the handle and you know, say something he couldn't take back or actually hit somebody backstage. I don't think Scott Steiner is going to make either one of our teams here, but he was another one of them who famously just like was a little bit nuts. And I think Savage falls on just the right side of that line where it was enough to be interesting without kind of crossing over to like, I actually don't want to deal with this guy because I don't know what he's going to do. So I'll put the Macho Man there as my number three pick.
Nice. I guess my next one would have to be, The Undertaker.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, so I think The Undertaker, if I'm not mistaken, and you have to verify this for me, but I think The Undertaker has been popular since, I want to say like 1990 is when he...
Yeah, that's when he debuted for WWF.
Okay. Where was he before that?
So he was in WCW and he was in a bunch of smaller promotions for not a long time, but for I'd say, you know, a 5-year-ish period where he worked with Dean Mark and a few other variations on that, Big Red at one point.
Right. Okay. So I think that, you know, he's had a ton of notable matches over the years. You know, he's wrestled Hulk Hogan, he's wrestled, I see on the list you have Mick Foley, and Mankind, and, you know, Cactus Jack, whatever you want to say. But, you know, I think he was in a match with The Rock, too. And he's aside from the pile driver, which I really enjoy as far as the finishing Tombstone, moves go. Yeah. Or Tombstone.
No, that is the pile driver.
It's the Tombstone pile driver, yeah. You know, I don't know. I just always thought he was kind of cool. And to your point earlier about somebody who really sees value in staying in character and everything mm-hmm. like that. So, you know, again, you would probably be able to speak better to the technical abilities in the ring and, you know, his physical abilities, you know, to whatever extent they are. But just as like as a wrestler and somebody that is particularly likable, in my mind, I would have to pick The Undertaker.
No, I'm sure that there are some exceptions to this and guys I'm not thinking of right now, but I would actually place him as one of the extremely few guys who main evented and was like a top star throughout the 90s, but actually was better in the ring in the 2000s and the 2010s. He had this stretch from, I want to say like 2005, 2006-ish until the early 2010s. When he was great in the ring, where he put on some of the best matches, and in a way that no one would really see coming, because that was never his thing. He was very much a character guy, and then he sort of became this great worker. I think just based on experience, based on the gravitas of the character, he's a self-professed huge MMA fan, and I think he borrowed a lot of offensive style from MMA that kind of elongated his career because he mixed it up a little bit more. It's hard to argue with that pick there. So I'm gonna do a left turn here and go in kind of a different direction. I've been picking kind of workhorse guys, so I think we're the best in the ring and all that. In this case, I'm gonna switch gears to Andre the Giant, who particularly by the 90s was nothing to write home about as an in-ring worker. Even by the 80s, he was more or less kind of washed up physically. One of the secrets of the business is he wore that, you know, black singlet kind of thing for the tail end of his career. The reason he switched to that from more conventional trunks was he had a back brace hidden under there because he couldn't move anymore. He needed that to support his body. But you know, just in terms of a spectacle of a human being, there's only ever been one Andre the Giant. I don't think there ever will be someone quite like him again. And specifically in that era, like now, I don't know how well the character works. Everyone expects everyone to be a little bit more athletic and all that. And he was never like a bodybuilder type. He was just a huge human being. I don't know how all that would fly now, but you know, in terms of legends of the business, undeniable. One of the all-time greats, one of the biggest stars the business ever saw.
That was a good pick. That was going to be my next pick.
All right.
So, yeah. Well, thanks. I guess, are we on our fifth one now?
Yeah, this is your last pick. You got Bret Hart, Flair, The Rock, and The Undertaker on your lineup so far.
Right. Now, hear me out on this one. Not the biggest star in the world or anything, and certainly not, as time went on, kind of went a bit downhill here, but anybody who can body slam Yokozuna definitely catches my eye. So I'm going to have to go with Lex Luger. You know, again, physically, I think he had, he's got all the right tools to be able to be a, you know, really good wrestler and just strong and everything like that. And, you know, again, I know he was big a certain portion of like the 90s. And then as his career progressed and afterward, you know, I think he ended up in a wheelchair. Right. Yeah. So, so you know, I'm sure that there's probably better wrestlers out there, but this is who I get to assemble as part of my team. So I want to pick him.
No, you know, and Luger's one of those guys who he was never really the guy, or at least not for, or he would be like the guy for like a couple months or so. Mm-hmm. He never kind of crossed over to be like that next Hulk Hogan. I think a lot of people kind of earmarked him to be at a certain point. But he was always in the mix. He was always towards the top, you know, and he never actually won a world title in WWF, but he did in WCW at least a couple times. You know, and he was always kind of, you know, the second guy behind Sting in WCW and kind of, yeah, I think ultimately overshadowed by Bret Hart and The Undertaker in WWF, but he was always right there in that mix of like, if anybody, you know, quite pulled the trigger or if he like, you know, committed himself that little bit more, maybe could have been, you know, that guy. So I think especially as a 90s wrestler, he's one of the few guys on this list who I'd really uniquely identify as a 90s guy. Because a lot of them where it's like, really, they kind of peaked in the 80s, but they still, you know, were active in the 90s. They are in consideration. Or really, they peaked afterwards. It's their longevity into the 2000s that gets them a spot on the all-time great list. Luger, really, if you go from 1990 to 2000, you've pretty much got the picture there. I know he did some work before and after, but that's certainly his prime years. And, you know, I think that's a fair place to go for this. But sort of like, I'm going to go, again, a little bit left field for my last pick here. I think there are better talents on the list here. I think, you know, I should mention, you know, Sting, I think, you know, more objectively speaking, would be a really good pick for this last one. Mick Foley, I think, deserves consideration. In terms of just star power, Hulk Hogan has to be in the conversation. But I'm going to go with a more personal favorite here of Big Van Vader. This guy, especially in his WCW work, was just like a dominant heel monster. I don't know if you remember this. I remember watching it with you, a match between him and Sting where he was just pounding on Sting in the corner. And Sting is actually just covering his head at one point. He's not even fighting back. He's just trying to not get hurt. And I remember you kind of raising the point, because we were both, you know, little kids at that point, you know, and I think we both understood it wasn't real, but we also had one foot in the kind of imagining it was real. And it's like, why is Sting covering up? Why is he not fighting back? And it was just like, Vader is such a badass that can't fight back at this point. You know, and you learn, and you know, again, I've listened to a million podcasts, read, you know, a ton of wrestling books. You know, you learn that Vader, to a point, was actually kind of a jerk in real life. He was kind of a mean guy. You know, when he looks like he's hitting people so hard, a part of that is because often he really was hitting guys really hard. And that was his style. Like he insisted, like, I'm going to hit you really hard. You hit me really hard back. We're going to make this look 100% real.
Some people are like, we don't want to do that.
There's all these rumors, and this is where that you play with that line of what's real and what's not, you know, and there's always rumors of guys who legitimately like quit or at least like, you know, backed off when it was like they found they were going to be booked against Vader. It was like, no, I don't want to be in the ring with that guy. Like this is dangerous. You know, and there's lots of rumors when he came to WWF that actually, between the way you would hit people hard and the fact that apparently he just smelled really bad, people actually kind of politicked against him. And like, he was supposed to have a run as like the world champion and the top guy. But Shawn Michaels and his buddies kind of rallied against it and kind of were like, no, we don't want to work with this guy. We don't want him to be on top. And kind of got their way out of it. And you never know 100% how much of that is true and how much that's like, they sort of did it, but that's not really the reason. You know, it's all hearsay at a certain point. But in any event, you know, just for his presentation, I remember especially in WCW, I just thought he was kind of like the coolest. And I was just kind of merging into that age where it was like, you know, the bad guys are kind of cool, right? Like, I don't just want to root for the good guys every time. Like this guy seems like a legitimate monster almost, you know? So in any event, that's where he gets the last spot on my team of Shawn Michaels, Steve Austin, Randy Savage, Andre the Giant, and Big Van Vader. You kind of run the gamut there between the guys who could fly and fight and whatnot, and the guys who were just so physically imposing. That's like, who's going to mess with these guys? So that's my team there.
That's a good lineup.
But all right. Well, I had some fun doing this. I hope you did, Mike, and listeners, obviously, you know, I hope you enjoyed what we had to say. So we'll be back with at least one more episode. We have one more plan that I think we're gonna have some fun with, you know, talking about the 90s. But I want to thank all of our listeners. And as always, I want to thank our friend Mike Peek for providing our theme music for the show. But otherwise, please be kind, rewind. We'll catch you next time.